Wallet Show this week, when should I buy and sell? Hi, I'm Christia. With me as always, Simon Brown. Well, Simon is with me, but actually not with me. We're trying something new this week. I have a bit of a bug, so we're doing a Skype call so that I don't infect Simon.
It's also raining.
It's also raining, but since our business is only two people, you know, half of us should be well at all times.
But if it's going to rain this much, we should live in Durban, just saying.
If you're new to this podcast, please be warned that a bleep version of the show is available at justonelap.com. That's who we are. Thank you to our friend Sean Combrink for doing that for us. Our indices this week are, what do you think, Si?
Down.
So actually, it's looking pretty good. The ZAC 1 LAP index is only down 4%. Like, this is how I've adjusted my expectations over the year. Like, if we're down less than 5%, I'm like, oh man, what a day. What a day. Needless to say, our listener love index, not so lucky. 17.21% down since August, 2017 that we did that?
Yeah, and ZAC was August last year. So ZAC's almost 6 months. So I'm trying to see what the top 40. The top 40 is down 6%. So he's holding on to the top 40.
You know what? He's pretty consistently beaten the market since we started this. So I think I will believe that the market is doing very well when the ZAC 1 LAP index is doing very well. Because I think his index is a bit better than the top 40, to be honest.
Yeah.
Well, he has been.
And the love index is just broken.
Yeah. I mean, but yeah. We knew that. But it's cool. Like, I like having that broken index there because it just makes it, you know, easy to see why index methodology is actually a very important thing, you know. Otherwise, it seems like we're not doing this for any good reason. So our winner of the week this week is Mukhtar. He solved our tax on real estate investments issue. He says, in the latest podcast, there was a question whether listed property distributions are treated as interest income or taxed as normal income. I can confirm that it's taxed as normal income and the interest exemption does not apply. So he actually attached a copy of his ITA 34. He says, you can see that an exemption only applied to interest income. The real estate investment trust income was just added to my other income without exemption. There's no deduction for this. For this reason, I try to keep all of my listed property exposure in tax-free investment accounts. And then,
You don't get that $23,000.
No, you don't, because I thought that it's just interest income, but it's not. So Shane Bester on the Fat Wallet Community Forum, he also says, dividends distributed by a real estate investment trust is subject to normal tax in the hands of the shareholder, and he quoted the Income Tax Act there. So that seems to take care of that question.
Okay, but then folks like Stealthy are right, that if you're going to have a lot of property ETFs, stick them in your tax-free so that you have none of this hit whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly.
Corinne Richards was saying something on Twitter. She says that Treasury has officially said they're not going to increase those exclusions of 23 and 30-odd thousand if you're older at all ever again, because now you use your tax-free for those exclusions.
Man, that's so sneaky.
Yeah.
I suppose that's also another very good reason to be involved in the tax-free space, right?
Yeah. The drawback is that you can only do $33,000 a year deposit. So you will get in time, but it's going to take you some time to get to the point where you worked it out, about $350,000 or something, that then hits that limit where you need to pay tax. It's going to take you 10 years.
Yeah.
So start young.
So actually, from that Wild and Tax-Free podcast that we did with Easy Equities, a few things have really stuck with me after that podcast. So I have been contributing in my tax-free investment space. I've been buying Ashburton 1200. If you guys don't know why we choose that one, we did a podcast called One ETF to Rule Them All, where we speak about why we chose that specific one. And then I started to get worried because I saw one of your power hours at the JSE, and you were saying, look, it's going to be SA Inc., you know, it's all going to be a growth story from now on. And I was like, I don't have any, you know, I've got outside of my tax-free a small amount in South African like top 40 shares, but nothing else really. So my plan was in the next tax year to go on to buying top 40 or whatever in my tax-free. But then when we did that wild and tax-free recording, Stealthy Wealth was saying something. He reminded me of something that I always say to other people and then conveniently forgot myself. He was saying he determines his exposure based on what's happening in his RA, because he's got a company pension. And so, and with regulation 28, 70% of your investments have to be in South African equity. And I had completely forgotten about that. So this week I'm going to sit down and just run the numbers and just get a sense of, because I know how much money I have in my RA. I know 70% of that money is in South Africa. So that will give me a rand amount. And then I can compare that to my tax-free amount. And then I'll know exactly where my exposure is. So that's been a, conversation has been really interesting. If you guys missed it, it's called Wild and Tax-Free. You can go search for it on justonelap.com.
But it's also, it's so when we see rand strength, and our rand is currently collapsing again, but you know, if you're offshore invested and you got rand strength, it's going to hurt. But you know, for maybe 3 years, maybe 5 years, but you know, we're doing this for the rest of our lives. And I know we check our portfolios frequently, but truthfully, the short term shouldn't bother us.
Yeah. The other thing that I've been thinking about, Njabulo in that recording said something that, at the time, I was like, okay, this is a game changer. But then I thought about it some more and I was like, actually, it's not a game changer. So when you get a 33,000 rand tax-free allowance every year, and the tax-free accounts opened in 2015, I think. You could open one from 2015. And the first 2 years, it was 30,000 rand, but you can't do extras. So if you guys don't know how that works, we've got that tax-free presentation coming up this Thursday at the JSE. You can join us there for free. But Njabulo was saying, look, if you missed a contribution in the first year, you can always make it up later, right? So it's not like you only have 15 years to contribute and then after 15 years, they're going to discontinue tax-free. So you can just make it up later. However, first of all, you can't make up the time, right? No. So the money I invested in 2015 is going to work harder for me than any of the other money that I ever put in, right? Mm-hmm. And also, if that limit falls away, you can't make it up, right? Because
The 500 limit.
The 500,000 rand limit. If that falls away, then you can never, like, that time then becomes, you know.
Anyway. It's also, I mean, in his sense, so he's not doing the full 33. So say he's doing 20 a year and then, you know, he can't quite do 20 this year. He does 15. Next year he can do 25. So in that sense, yes, but to the big point is that he misses the time. Now, if you only miss 1 year over a 20, 30, 40-year period, it's going to have an impact, but it's not going to be the end of the world. But it's if you stick it in 5 years later, you're missing time. And time is the biggest asset we have when we're investing.
Yeah. All right. Warren had we had some feedback on last week's episode from Warren and Paul. Warren said there's a great site. So I don't know if you remember, but Nadia last week was asking about learning about Forex trading. Mm-hmm. So Warren says there's a great site called Baby Pips where she can learn everything.
Excellent.
Also, there's a company called Oanda based in the UK, which I've been trading on for 6 years, and it's all legit. There are no minimums and no admin fees. So that's cool feedback there for Nadia, if you're still thinking, if we didn't dissuade you last week. I think we did a bad job.
Probably. Baby Pips is the one that everyone talks about. I was trying to remember it, but couldn't.
Okay. And then Paul also had some feedback. He said, the best thing I heard this week is something that you said last week, Simon. If you want to know what Forex trading is, withdraw 2,000 rand from the ATM and burn it. If you can't, then you can't do Forex trading either. Paul says, I wish I heard this phrase a few years ago when I was also sold the yacht and bubbles lie and burned a couple of thousand trying my hand at Forex trading. So there you have it, Nadia.
Yeah. Burn your money.
So we got two emails this week that more or less had to do with when to buy and sell shares in ETFs. And I was thinking, since there are people, you know, like Sean Morrison from IG Spring to Mind and Mashima Gama, you know, there are people literally who spend their entire careers trying to find the right time to buy and sell shares, you know. But I thought that maybe we could discuss some rules of thumb to help. So I'm just going to go through... I think let's do one email at a time. So we got an email from Stephen and an email from Monet. And then Gerard also had kind of a related email. Stephen says, I'm toying with the idea of moving all of my ETFs across both my normal and tax-free portfolios into a bond ETF, the new funds Gavi he was looking at. He says the idea would be to leave my investment in a more stable environment and then move them back into my original portfolio when the market is low. So he holds Ashburton 1200, CoreShares Global, NASDAQ, MSCI Emerging, and S&P 500. He says, on my normal accounts, I haven't made enough to warrant capital gains. I moved from single shares to ETFs in my normal account after Steinhoff and also not realizing I should have sold Dis-Chem in the high 30s. It was then that I realized I was like a gambler, talking about the gains and not about the losses. This is so funny because this is what everybody does. At the moment, the only single shares I have are Naspers and Steinhoff, and only because I can't bear to accept defeat along with my single concentration stupidity. Shame, man. He says, is this an advisable approach? I want to be fluid for when recession opportunities arise, or should I be looking elsewhere for stable return during market downturns? So...
So let's say, and we'll come to the selling in a moment, but let's say he times his sell perfectly. The odds are zero, but let's say one does. Now you've also got to time your entry, and he talks about recession times. I mean, the problem with recession times is that they are deeply scary, and the last thing you want to do is put your money in the market. And if we go back to the crisis of 08-09. I invested a lot in September 08 and it fell 20%. I put a whole bunch more in December 08 and it fell another 20%. And then finally in March of 2009, it hit the bottom. So what I thought was being brave and timing perfectly, et cetera, just did not work. It just, you know, I got it horribly wrong. And I'm not a Mishima Gamma or a Sean Morrison, but you know, I was on a trading floor of 400 people at Standard Bank, and collectively no one actually got it right. And the research out there says quite simply that the risk is that you miss a couple of good days in the market, and that has massive impact. If you were a week late into entering, you know, that has significant impact into your ultimate return. And another research I saw on Twitter just a week or two ago, that if you had bought at the all-time highs in the crises of 08, of 2001, of 98, of 87, of 69, etc., even if you had bought at the worst possible times, you're still beaten cash massively. So, I mean, the theory is nice. The theory is excellent. The timing is just like really, really, really hard.
It's impossible, and everybody says this. And this is why that is such a cliche when people say it's time in the market and not timing the market, because you just don't know.
Yeah, like, I just wish Old Mutual had never coined that phrase.
You know what? Let me just park that there.
but absolutely, and I mean, and I think I've mentioned this before. Someone emailed me towards the end of last year. She had sold well in that she had exited back in February, just when everything was looking lovely, and our market was already off the highs. And she said to me, "Well, I got my exit right. Should I be buying now?" And my answer to her was, "I don't know."
Yeah, and this is exactly the point. Like, I think if what's always astounding to me about the markets and about people who work in the markets is that I don't think anybody knows what's going on, really, right? Like, no. you know kind of sort of what to expect in general terms, but nobody really knows what is going on 100% of the time. Like, sometimes you're lucky and you get it, but... You know, like, it's a guessing game for everybody. And so what you're trying to do when you buy and sell is you're trying to get your averages right, right? So you want to yeah, rand cost average and, you know, over time see that go up. And like trying to, because I see what Stephen wants to do. Like, he wants to make the most of every type of market situation, which is not a... You know, it's a very ambitious thing to want to do, and it makes a lot of sense, except that there aren't any objective ways to know whether you should come in or out. Having said that, though, Absa are launching three new ETFs that are that kind of do what Stephen wants to do. So they called the target, they called target volatility ETFs. And basically what Absa have said is, if you, so these ETFs invest in a selection of shares, and if market volatility goes crazy, they cash you out of the share, or they cash you out of the share. So you basically go into cash. When the market volatility calms down again, they put you back. And the, the theory is, like, you don't have those huge bumpy rides in your portfolio, you know, where you, where prices go up and down. When things go super crazy, like 2008 market crash level crazy, you go into cash. And for an investor, that's a really, I think psychologically, that's very powerful, because you don't see those massive bumps in your portfolio.
Yeah, so I was looking at their documents, and if you look at the one which is the sort of for very people, very risk adverse people, it really it does what it says on the sticker. What it also does is it takes some of the shine out of your returns, but it does give you a much more gentle ride along the way, in order to make it happen. The other thing that Stephen has to worry about, is that he's, all of his holdings were offshore, which means that he's now got to time two things. One is offshore markets, two is the currency.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
And that, you know, really what does the, make the, it the three impact, times as hot.
And the impact of the currency is going to be, is generally going to be a lot more noticeable than the impact of actual market movements offshore, because it's so short term. So, yeah, because the currency moves a lot in a short period of time, whereas, like, developed markets tend to not move that much in a short period of time. So that's going to be, it's going to be a difficult thing to time. What I really like about these target volatility ETFs is, I think if you are very new to investing, these ETFs are going to be a very cool way for you to learn about investing without having all the horrible fear and dread, you know, that comes from volatility.
I mean, they look really, really lacquer, and even the sort of the aggressive one, which, you know, and they've got lots of bits and pieces behind them in terms of drawdowns and all of those complexities and the like, but they just they make those horror periods, which you know, really was 08 09. What we've seen in the last couple of months has been minor by comparison, but they make those horror periods much easier to stomach. Particularly, it's easy for me to say, you know, don't panic, but, you know, because I've been doing this for, you know, 22 years and had four market crises in the period, and probably messed up the first three and half messed up the fourth one. It's easy to say don't panic. It's a lot harder to actually not panic.
Yeah.
Especially when you're a newbie. Another point on the data out there, and this was something, so I always thought it would be better to stagger an investment. Let's say you've got your 33,000. I always thought it was better to then put it into the market, 2,750 Rand a month, so that you catch some of those pullbacks and you get that Rand cost averaging, etc. And again, the data says, no, it's better to put it in on day one. There is a chance that you put it in on day one and the market crashes. And emotionally, that's going to be an absolute horror show. But you know, the bottom line is, it's actually just better to get in the market and give yourself that time.
But what the data doesn't say is how much fun it is to do one transaction every month. Because with the tax, in the tax-free space, I've been very lucky in that I've been able to put in the 33,000 at the beginning of every financial year, except for last year, I couldn't do it. And it was so much fun for me to do a transaction every month. And I know, you know, like, I wanted to say, I know it's not about fun, but actually it also is about fun. Like, you should enjoy your money as well.
No, fair point. And there's something to that. And then a last point onto Stephen, which is not a massive point, and because it's in a tax-free account, there's no tax implication. But every time you buy and sell, you incur costs. So 0.5% just in transaction fees, 0.25% either side. So let's say 0.5% in total. And on top of that, you've got to cross the spread. That difference between the buy and sell from the ETF issuer, let's call that another 0.5% each way. So that's 1.5%, you know, every round trip, which is not huge, but it's you know, you start on the back foot of -1.5, and you now got to get your timing right to catch that 1.5 back.
Yeah, it's not huge, but it's also not insignificant. And the more you do it, the more you pay it. So that's
So a very last point on this. There is this. In fact, they're both in Durban. Two peeps in Durban who have been trading their tax-free accounts. And the one guy's got his up to, so we've put in about, what, 130,000, 129, I think it is. And he's got his, the one's got it up to about 160, and the other guy's at almost 200,000 trading. So they've both done incredibly well, but they're actively trading it. But the important point is, these are two peeps who've come to me and told me how well they've done. The person who's put 129K in and turned it into 60,000 hasn't mentioned it to me. So there's a bias here, which you mentioned a moment ago, whereby, you know, you hear about the winners, you don't hear about the folks who didn't do so good.
Yeah, and it's funny, when we talk about our portfolios, we tend to do that as well. Oh, I made so much money doing this, and then you just forget to mention all the money you lost.
Yeah, I mean, life does it. We all talk about Warren Buffett or Jeff Bezos or something, but if you read Nassim Taleb's first book, Fooled by Randomness, I mean, the truth is there were 10,000 Buffetts and one survived, and there were 10,000 Bezos and only one got to the top. And we ignore the other 9,999 and pretend that all 10,000 could have been Buffett. And the answer is no.
It's because we all think we're a unique snowflake and we've got what it takes. But actually, most of us don't.
What's that stat? If you're one in a million, there's 7,000 of you.
Yeah. Okay, so Monet had a similar question, but from the other side. He says, I decided to convert my portfolio from single company ETFs, mostly to avoid risks and not to have to follow shares religiously for opportunities. Mm-hmm. My approach is to slowly sell my single company shares as they move into the green or break even, and then use the money to buy ETFs. This is only for my South African account, since I already decided to focus on ETFs before I opened my US account. I was delighted to see that the ETFs I chose are also rated very highly in your podcast. As I'm selling my single stocks, the cash I have available for ETFs is growing. However, the cash in both my South African and US accounts are earning basically zero interest, and this irritates me greatly. My dilemma now is when to buy an ETF. Do I wait for a price drop, or do I buy at any price when I find an ETF that I like, since I'm investing for the long term? The same goes for ETFs that I already own. Should I wait for price drops or keep on adding to them from month to month, regardless of the price?
Just buy them.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, just buy them. I do have a comment on his selling of the shares. He says he sells them as they pop into the green. I think his strategy is wrong, because when something pops back into the green, it's got some price momentum behind it, and it might go a bit greener. And something that is in the red has got, you know, negative price momentum behind it and might go redder. And whilst you might be prepared to wait, you know, EOH or Steinhoff suggest that wait might be the rest of your life. I would either just bail them and move the money, or find a different strategy, you know, like, I don't know, are you above the 50 moving average? Keep it below, sell it regardless.
Okay. I don't know if that's going to, the 50 moving average is going to make sense to anybody on this podcast.
Google it.
Google it.
Or better yet, don't Google it and live in ignorance. It's quite a comfortable place to be.
I agree. We should all do that. Why are we doing this podcast? Gerard has actually done what Monet wants to do, and now he is worried about the tax implications of it. So he... Okay, let me read his email. Let me not try and paraphrase it. He says, 4 years ago, we had a lot of credit card debt, month-to-month living, and we were always broke. I discovered Mr. Money Moustache and the Financial Independence Retire Early movement. I took control of my expenses, and now I have multiple savings and investment accounts and no more debt. It took about 2 years to get rid of most of the debt, and the house is almost done. And since I've been just been building investments accounts. So I just wanted to say, as an aside, it took me about 2 years to get rid of my debt as well. So if you are in a lot of debt and you are very aggressive, this is the timeline that you should be looking at. If you only have a little bit of debt, obviously, then it won't take as long. But if you were like me and you were royally this is how long it's going to take you. So he says, Gerard says, last year I decided to start adding extra money to the Easy Equities taxable account. I bought about 40 shares to simulate my own index based on the Core Shares Top 50. One morning I logged onto the Easy Equities platform and decided that it's just too much admin for such little long-term rewards. Just pay the total expense ratio, buy the ETFs and stop stressing about this. He says rebalancing and buying 40 shares every month gets annoying very quickly. He says, I then sold everything, not really understanding the tax consequences. I'm sitting with my first ever tax event. I get this for a tax event. He made 300 Rand.
Hey, he has a tax event. That's a big deal. Not everyone's had a tax event.
When I first read this email, I was like, did he forget to put the K at the end? Or and then I was like, no, it's just 300 Rand. He says, would I be able to put this through as capital gains, as my intent is for this account to be long-term holdings? Or is it just better to declare the small profit I made as an income? I can't prove as yet that it's a long-term, other than showing SARS my retirement planning spreadsheet. And on such a small amount of profit, I just want to do it as an income declaration. My one major worry is that if I declare this as income this year, will SARS always see this account as a trading account? Or is I think this is a very good question.
Yeah, so I mean, the declaring it as income or CGT, your tax difference is minor, and frankly, SARS needs it, so let's be generous here. The point is that if you were rebalancing monthly, it's income. There's no two hoots around it. So declare it as income. But the second half of the question is a really good one. So what about going forward? So tax law is always around intent, and he can use as proof, truthfully, he can use the email to us or this podcast as proof that, yes, I was doing this and now I'm not. So I've gone from active income to, you know, slow and lazy capital gain, and therefore it's as capital gain. And, you know, the intent is intent's hard to prove, but in this case he has a paper trail or an email trail which he can show to SARS and say, yeah, I tried, I failed, and I'm moving on to this.
But look, if he's really engaging in a long-term strategy, he wouldn't be declaring a capital gain in the next 5 or 10 years anyway. So then the time will just prove that it's capital gains.
So I wouldn't stress it. I got to say, to the point, I mean, I know some peeps who tried this probably about 10 or so years ago, where to avoid the TERS, they replicated the ETFs and traded them themselves.
But that can't make sense because the TERS are so low. And as you just mentioned before, like every trade that you do costs money.
Yeah.
So and every trade that you do costs more than the TER of a cheap ETF. So.
And half 10 years ago, if you were getting 0.5% on a fee, you were doing well. Now you can get 0.25. Yeah. It just didn't work out. And they got, you know, and I forget the exact numbers, but they got slaughtered in terms of performance relative to the ETF after paying the TER.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so last week we handled one question from our tax elf, Devet. He wanted to know about emergency funds, and do you remember he wanted to split it between him and his wife? So he's leaving his cushy corporate job to take his tax elving more seriously, and he's downscaling his life significantly. So we are, he sent a monster long email, so we're doing one of his questions every week until we've gotten through them. He says, I'm looking to save a percentage of all my income per month for both me and my wife for tax purposes. This would be anywhere between 25 and 31%. What is the best use of this money during the period that I have access to it? This normally sat in my bond or home loan. Further down, I will have some more on managing my taxes. So, he, as far as I understand it, he is not going to take on another home loan or bond at this point. And so he can't use his access bond for this money anymore. This is what I'm going to do, by the way. My tax savings now is going into my access bond.
Yeah, and the beauty of your access bond is that you save, basically you earn by saving whatever your interest rate is. Let's call it 10%. So you're earning 10% on the money because, you know, just you pay it off quicker. But there's no tax liability on that 10%. So
I always forget about that.
Yeah. No, it's the lack of tax because the flip is you go and put it into a high income bank account, right? And there's bunches of those. African Bank, Capitec, they've all got
Bank now.
Time Bank, they're all offering. I mean, just shop around and be ruthless, you know, move as the new rates are better somewhere else. but any of that income and you know is taxable. Now, you've got to have 350K, so if you're earning less than $1 million a year, it's probably not an issue. You're unlikely to hit that tax threshold, except, of course, you've also got an emergency fund. And I remember from last week, Devet, much like I do, wants a large emergency fund. Mm. So suddenly you're earning interest and you're paying tax on it, which does make an access bond really, really nice. And it's one of the things I've struggled with, because that's where I used to hide or park most of my emergency money, was in the access bond. I no longer have an access bond, and now I'm earning interest out of my nose, and it's going to cost me money.
You are welcome to use my access bond anytime, yeah. Both of you.
So that's exactly what my sister said. So I'm happy to do it for a mere 9.6%.
All right. So where should he put it? Because he doesn't have the access bond.
Yeah, so shop around to the various different banks. And because it's tax, you can actually go 32-day call, because you've got a bit of notice around, you know, you do your tax return, you've got an understanding of what you owe, you know when the dates are.
That is such a good point. That is so clever.
So you can basically it's shop around. And what we don't have, unfortunately, is one website which says these are all the rates. Or maybe we do, in which case let us know.
Stealthy would do.
Yeah, but so because I mean some of the institutions have been offering decent rates. I mean, African Bank has had the best call rate for a while now, but you might get better at 32-day. Find the bank with the best, make sure that it's a zero cost account, and off to the races.
Cool. Andre, he is our new minimalist contributor. So once a month, he writes for us about minimalism and how he implements it in his life.
He's also a D&D fan.
Yes, he is. And he had
Massive points.
He had in half the camp, it earns a massive points.
Yes, you're stinging.
Anyway, he had such a great insight. He said the lower your savings rate is, the higher rate of return you'll need to get on your savings in order to retire. And the lower your savings rate is, the more important time becomes. So that's really, it was just, he just had this thought and he shared it with us. And I thought that was really, really interesting. I also thought about I did an interview on Aris Gier a while back about the financial independence retire early movement. And this morning I had a thought that whole movement, the whole premise of that movement is that the gap between your spending and your income needs to be as big as possible. Like if you want to have a comfortable retirement, you need to make the gap between, whether it's early or not early, you need to make the gap between your income and your spending as big as you possibly can.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's not about how to find the best investment solutions and stuff like that. Yes, they're moderately important, and you know, and it is about fees and stuff, but the key principle behind it seems to be very much of get your expenses down.
Yeah. So Wayne has some legacy active funds that he wants to know what to do with. He says, I'm invested in the Allan Gray Orbis Global Equity Feeder. Oh my goodness. With a TER of 2.16%, and he says in brackets, I just threw up in my mouth. He says, I have a large amount going to this monthly. It was a great idea before ETFs came along that could give me access to world stocks. I'm now also invested in the Signia MSCI World in my tax-free savings account, and that only has a TER of 0.68%. Should I be looking
to... And we consider that expensive.
Yes, we do. He says, should I be looking to invest or stop my monthly payments in Orbis? They had a shocking year in 2018. And put my funds into my Easy Equities account and invest in the Satrix or Signia World ETFs. I'm struggling to see the difference in the investment strategy between the two options. The ETF option definitely has a lower TER, and I don't know who to call for advice. So just before you answer this, Simon, I just wanted to say, Wayne, the fact that something had a shocking year the previous year, like that should not factor into your decision-making process, especially if you're a long-term investor, right? Like a short-term performance time horizon, that's actually not a very great way of knowing whether that's a good investment or not. Fees are a much better way to gauge whether or not you're going to get good returns. Okay.
Yeah, and he's 100% right, and as are you. And the difference in fees is 1.5%, which means Orbis needs to make an extra 1.5% every year to just be standing still. And of course, if they make that 1.5%, then they're beating the index, so they're going to take performance fees. So actually, they've probably got to do an extra 2% just to match it. Can they sustainably do that extra 2%? The evidence says not at all, and he should just exit. So the process is stop the new money into Orbit, whatever it is, and stick it into the ETF, and then check your CGT liability. Maybe you have no liability, in which case sell it. Maybe you only have 35K profit, in which case no stress because your first 40 is free. If you've got 70K profit, well, sell half this year, 35, half next year, 35, two different tax years and sort it that way.
Yeah, if you're very quick, you can still do it like now in February and then do the other one in March. And then you can be like within a month, you can be out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's nice and simple. And if you don't have yet 40,000 profit, then don't stress it because you haven't got a CGT liability there. And then just put the new money in, and then and there will be times when they have when their previous year was outstanding. But to your point, 1 year don't make nothing.
Yeah, just remember also, Wayne, that you are gonna continue paying that TER even when you stop contributing. And I know that seems very obvious, but you could stop contributing to this one. But if you keep the money invested there, that money is still going to keep costing you money. Man, I'm having that now with F&B because I had to reopen my F&B account because that's where I got my home loan. And so F&B now has like a R5 account option. And mm-hmm. I just went for the cheapest account that I could find. And now my home loan hasn't gone through yet. And every month they're like, cool, we're just going to take R5. So I put like R1,000 in there. And every month it just becomes less and less for literally no good reason. It's so irritating.
Yeah. Well, at least F&B isn't getting rich on your R5.
Well, they're getting R5 richer than I am, which is it's irritating me. So Mary is 42 and she discovered the financial independence idea last year. She says, since she started, I started saving for my emergency fund. I was a bit uncertain whether that amount should cover the medical aid as well. If so, I think I should rethink mine because as of now, I have about 4 months of expenses saved up. So Mary, I definitely think you should include your medical aid here. So what I do with my emergency fund is basically all of my expenses that aren't savings. So I try and have as much of that in cash available as possible. So that definitely for me, it includes my emergency fund and it includes my dread and disability cover as well.
Yeah, it includes all the insurance as well. And also a point in the medical aid, if you're working for a company, they might be contributing towards your medical aid. In other words, you're only paying 2, but they're paying 1, so your medical aid is actually 3.
Oh man, that's a really good point. So if you put together your emergency fund, put it together as if you have to pay the whole medical aid amount, because presumably you wouldn't be, man, you're so sharp today.
I'm thinking, I'm on fire, hey? The Skype thing
just
works.
It's like blowing my mind.
It's the altitude. I don't have to go up the big hill you live on top of. Mountain, as they call it. Yeah, and then all of your saving products you don't need to worry about. All of your other, those things, they can survive for a couple of months. But your insurance, your medical, and even, depending on how you want to be, I have 8 to 12 months of money, but truthfully, I could drop my standard of living and probably make it 16 or 24 months.
Yeah, that's you really want to be in that situation. But this problem gets solved when you have a very high savings rate, because all of your spending, if you have a savings rate of 50%, then automatically when you stop earning money, you spend 50% less than you did before.
Yes.
So her tax-free allocation is in a bank account in cash up until now. That's not a great idea, Mary. It's not a great idea at all. She also has an Allan Gray equity unit trust. She says, I was thinking of starting a tax-free portfolio in ETFs. And I didn't want a lot of extra individual ETFs. So she holds at the moment the Satrix 40, the All Bond Index, the S&P 500, and a property ETFs. She says, is it better to put 100% of the tax-free allowance in the high equity balanced index fund from Satrix or spread it around in different ones? I wouldn't go into a balanced, if you have a long enough time horizon, I wouldn't go into a balanced equity fund at all.
Yeah. And I mean, and 42 is positively young. and the best age, if you've read the Douglas Adams books, I wouldn't even have the bonds.
Yeah, no. So what I would do, Mary, if I were in your situation, is I would choose one ETF that I like. So in my case, that would be the Ashburton 1200. And I would just hoey everything into that one and have that be that. But you definitely need to move your tax-free allowance out of cash. That is not the best way to use that product.
Yeah, and when you move it, contact the providers, because someone wanted to move theirs and just put a withdrawal request.
Oh, no.
Just got an email from the service provider saying, are you withdrawing or are you moving? And it's like, no, I'm moving. And it's like, well, then you don't withdraw, you move. They're different.
Yeah. So you need to do a transfer of the funds. You can't just withdraw it from the one account and then transfer it to the other account.
Yeah. Just to point on what Mary's got, and let's drop the bond, the Satrix 40, the S&P 500 and property, and I'm not sure which property, but the point with the 40 and the 500 is that your idea, and I subscribe to it, about the Ashburton 1200, but you know, when the Rand goes crazy as it did, and now it's gone crazy the other way, it causes us pain and anguish. There's something to be said for that sleeping well at night, to actually just have some local, because it might be at points counter to what's happening in the other part of the world. And as we get smarter and more immune to the vagrancies of the market, we can sort of start saying, I don't care what happens over the next 5 years.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And maybe, Mary, also consider these new ABSA products. Like, if you're not entirely sure what to do, maybe this is also an option for you. So we got a mail from George for the first time in a long time. We haven't heard from him. He's turning 60 this year, and he's looking to start moving out of equities. And I think George is at the age you shouldn't start thinking about it, but you can start thinking about it. Because realistically, George, if you're 60, you could realistically live for another 30 or 40 years. So
you maybe have a 50% chance of making it to 92.
There we go. So don't go too crazy, George. He says, can you please advise what is the best bond ETF to reduce risk to buy in a tax-free investment account, which will give me the best return? And what percentage of my tax-free investment account should it be, as I mainly have equity ETFs in the account at the moment?
So I don't know that it's a bond ETF. I think it might be the government retail bonds, which has an inflation plus bond, which is a 10-year bond. And what it does is the capital grows by the inflation amount every year, and then you're paid 4% interest on that, and I think it pays out biannual. So basically you're getting a real return of 4%. The trick, of course, is tax implications. And whilst you can do these in a tax-free account, the limits are, you know, you're only 130K in so far. So it's not very much, in other words.
So I think he wants to move out of equities and into something like bonds in his existing tax-free account. And you can't buy these government retail bonds anywhere.
Except at the post office and Pick and Pay and other horrible places.
Yeah, so how would he do that tax-free, right?
So I don't know. I haven't done it. I mean, you would have to, I mean, check out their website. But I've never looked into them into a tax-free account. I do know that when it was done, because I read the legislation, they specify that the government retail bonds are applicable for tax-free investing. But failing that, the new funds ILBI, which is NFILBI, is an inflation-linked basket of bonds, and it trucks along very slowly, actually a little more volatile than I would have thought, but it does what it says on the sticker.
Well, hopefully this is not George's only retirement money, and maybe he can leave it for a bit longer. George, you might also want to look at the new fund's MAPS products. They've got a product called the MAPS Protect ETF, And that has a lot of bonds and cash in it, but it also has some equity. So I don't know. So go and look at the new funds ILBI, as Simon said, but also the new funds MAPS products, and also these target volatility
ones.
Products, they might also be a good option.
That low risk one looks like, I think, perhaps a real option, because it'll give you full equity at the right point in the cycle, but at the wrong point in the cycle, it will, in theory, give you full cash.
Full cash, right.
Yeah. So a last point of it, George, is and you're 60, which is still very, very young. You've got to be 86 to be old in my life. So sort of do that phase from 100% equity to a much lighter equity portfolio. Do it over a 10 or 15 year period.
Yeah. But I mean, if it's just his tax-free account, that's a...
Sure.
You know, that's... Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Karabo has investment properties. Listen to this. This email really just astounded me. She says, I have three properties that I bought in my early 20s as investments for my yet-to-be-born children. I'm turning 30 this year. So she doesn't have the kids yet, and she already has investment properties for her kids.
Well, no, that's the right way around, but no one does it that way around.
Incredible. I think that is so epic. Amazing. She said, I bought the properties in my name, but I would like to move them to a trust. Is it possible to do so? Would it be wise, or should I rather register a company that will own the properties on behalf of my children? I still owe the bank on the properties.
So a couple of tricks. Firstly, if you're moving into either a trust or a company, the move of the home loan is not just a click. They might actually want you to reapply. They might give you a different rate. They might turn the company or the trust down. And certainly they will charge you an initiation fee, which is what, 5,000 Rand or whatever the case may be. There are going to be costs in moving those properties. The other point is that both, we'll put it the other way, individuals have a much more favorable tax rate on a second property than companies and trusts. Our CGT is significantly lower that we pay as an individual. And because these aren't primary residents, they will be subject to CGT. The CGT is much more onerous within a company, a PTY, or a trust. And a lot of those loopholes have been closed where trusts used to be great. A lot of those loopholes have been shut down. You need a proper expert. The problem with a proper expert is that you're probably talking to a proper expert who is selling trusts or PTYs, i.e. they love them. So find a tax consultant.
So what if she, when she actually has a child, let's say, so she's got three properties, let's say she's planning on having three children. What if she just moves the property into the name of the baby when she has the baby? Would that be, what would that do?
So sure, she would, and she, so the tax liability would be hers. Until the baby was actually earning money, etc., etc. The truth is, at this point, there's probably, you know, there might be some tax liability, and she's already many years into it, having already started. But that's one option, is to move it in. The trick is, you got three properties, which kid gets which property. Intuitively, I like the idea of if you're going to go for a structure of doing it in a PTY, because then each child gets 33.3 shares and so on and so on. I'm just worried about the tax implication.
But she could also hold on to the properties until a kid is born, then sell the property and invest the profit from the property in a, like a listed company or a listed property ETF or something.
Put it into the child's
tax-free account, like in the child's name. Because as Patrick pointed out in that Wild and Tax-Free podcast that we did, if you invested 33,000 Rand for your kid in the first year of their life, they would be able to retire off that money when they're 60. So that's...
Not with yachts and bubbles, but retire.
Yeah, they wouldn't have to... So Always Abundant is starting to understand the impact of the exchange rate on their investments. They say 50% of my portfolio is invested in the Vanguard World ETF in US dollars. The other 50 is local. So the top 40 ETFs, Satrix Indy, Signia Local Property, some local unit trusts, some individual South African shares. They say, recently I realized that the exchange rate plays a bigger role than performance when it comes to the profitability of my offshore investments when converted back to rands. This is a scary thought as I have no plans to immigrate and I've always needed to sell at an inopportune time with regards to the forex rate. And this is exactly what we were talking about earlier, like Rand dollar exchange rate moves all the time, so if you need the money immediately, or you know, you run a very big risk of having to sell at a bad rate. They say, I thought to find a suitable local ETF to counteract that risk. Unfortunately, it seems to me that apart from mid caps and local property, perhaps everything is impacted by the exchange rate. Is this a logical concern, or am I overlooking something at a time where everyone around me is investing offshore? If my concern is logical, what is a good investment for South Africans who don't wish to be exposed to the currency risk?
Yeah, so I mean, he's right, and the trick is that our currency is very volatile. So if you were living in Europe and investing in dollars in the US, the currency is moving 1 or 2% a month or a quarter or something. You know, our currency's moved sort of 7% in a week. So massively, massively volatile. So it does get spooky. Is there a way to actively remove the currency? Yes, but it costs money and is, you know, you need to use currency futures. You can totally remove the currency exposure, but it's not cheap. You've got to go and get currency futures, and but you know, you're basically long the dollar, so now you've got to go short the dollar in the futures contract, and it's not viable. It's just not viable.
But I mean, why can't they just do local ETFs if they're like, okay, I don't want to be exposed to this, so rand denominated ETFs.
But I mean, the impact. I mean, for example, when we're recording on Thursday, Wednesday, the rand crashed out from 1360 to 1390, and all of our sort of offshore stocks, Richemont, Mondi, BTI, and all of those suddenly went through the moon, and that was the Indy 25 index that did really well. The Resi did even better. Our market, as we said before, some 2/3 of their profits come beyond the borders of South Africa. There's no completely escaping. He is right that the mid cap is significantly less dependent on offshore.
Also such a index at the moment. I mean, I wouldn't touch it with a stick.
Yeah, and I mean, it's currently full of all sorts of. It's all the stuff that gets kicked out of the top 40 ends up in the mid cap.
It's a garbage bin of an ETF.
Half of it is garbage and half of it is rising stars, but they kind of cancel each other out and the garbage seems to win. So you can't remove it. I mean, so the short answer is there's no practical, cost-effective way to remove the impact of the currency. The longer issue is, don't stress it. I mean, you know, this is we mentioned already in this podcast that investing is the long term, and I know we're looking at things in the short term, and yes, the currency moved 7% in a week or 10 days or whatever it was, but ignore the short term.
Cool. This Thursday, the 21st of February, we'll be doing our annual tax-free presentation at the JSE in Johannesburg. It's a free event. You can still register for that event and join us on Thursday evening. A lot of the ETF issuers will be there. Easy Equities will be there. Nerina Visser will be there. So I think that's going to be a really, really fun event. And then that means next week we will not have a podcast. Our show next week is just going to be audio from that event. So that's it from the Just One Lap team this week. Please remember that this is a show about questions. Send yours to ask@justonelap.com. You can also join the Fat Wallet community group on Facebook. Thank you to Aiden Whitaker and Kay Carmichael for being our community wizards over there. My name is Christopher Hedden. Thank you very much to Simon Brown. We'll catch you again next time.